The lead singer caught my eye and signaled the other two. They paused, and everyone looked around to see why. The blonde singer sat down on a pink velvet ballroom chair. Mabel from housekeeping picked up the fruit and the smashed chocolates, frowning at the waste and at poor Missy, shaking in my arms, peeing on my skirt. I carried Missy out of the room. Tully followed with Missy's handbag. Two of the Secret Service guys met me at the elevator. We took the elevator to the third floor. I'd never been to Missy Lehan's room before. It was like a maid's room in Hyde Park. One high, joyless window, one narrow twin bed, too short for anyone who had a decent childhood, a stained marble basin and a wood vanity, so old the lacquer was coming off in dismal brown strips, like the last leaves. There was a big crystal vase filled with fading tulips and some letters weighed down with two snow globes of the White House. By the time we'd undressed her and put her in her white pajamas with the pink piping, which were a gift from Eleanor the year before, the doctor was knocking on the door. Her mouth hung open and her right eye fluttered like a moth. The doctor looked at my wet skirt and shoved us out of the little room. "I'm guessing it's a heart attack," he said. Tully and I walked down the hall, Tully still holding Missy's silver jacket. I could slip a note under Franklin's door, and he might love me for it. I wrote the note, and I stopped outside his closed office door and put it in my pocket. Whoever's job that was, it wasn't mine. Eleanor came back the next day and bustled while Missy lay there. She was her worst and her best self. She hired a cadre of nurses. She let people know that it was possible that this was all psychological. She arranged for massage therapists and doctors. And when Missy had another, bigger stroke, there was fresh fruit every day, cut very small, which Missy could hardly eat because her left side, from her eye to her chin, wasn't working at all. We had one ceremonial, excruciating visit from Franklin, rolling in with the big laugh and the flowers that Eleanor had put in his lap in the elevator. Eleanor hovered, and I walked down the stairs, so as to not kill anyone. "He hates illness," Eleanor said to me. "It's painful for him to see her this way. Missy is... she's always been so lively and charming." That's what we all said about Missy. We said it to White House staff. We said it to visitors. We said it to reporters. The idea that Franklin preferred his secretary to his wife didn't offend any newsmen. Not the Catholic ones, and not the married ones. Eleanor was a great lady, and what man in Christ's name wanted to be married to that? At 6, every day, Tully came by with carefully sifted news for Missy, which was worse than no news. It was the news that Eleanor and Franklin allowed Tully to give out to the cousins. Tidbits designed to look like the real thing. Missy LeHand had been Franklin Roosevelt's confidant and secretary and stage manager and mistress. Her ass had rested on the arm of Franklin's chair, the fabric of her dress flowing over his sleeve, both of them feeling an invisible electric wire between them. She'd sat in his lap while he looked at top-secret documents or read the paper, with her head on his shoulder. She rested her hands on his shoulders, while he mused about exactly what lie he would roll out in the middle of lunch with an irate cabinet member, and she laughed and gave him a kiss on the temple. "Oh, F.D.," she said, "aren't you a one?" She put on the Irish, which he loved. There was no kind of mockery he didn't love. And Franklin would say, when he felt too pressed, or backed into a corner, or reminded of something he'd promised to someone in need, who was now revealed to be a colossal pain in the ass, "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." We all knew that he'd heard that line from Winston Churchill, who learned it from Clementine Churchill, who had actually read T.S. Eliot's poems. Eleanor did better than Franklin. She brought embroidered pillows. She had Missy's robe cleaned and bought her two new ones, cotton, not satin, because it was summer and because there was no point pretending Missy wasn't spilling things down the front. Eleanor came into the room one morning, carrying small green crown-shaped bottles of Inauguration, the perfume Prince Machiavelli, an actual prince, had made for her. It smelled like carnations and burning rubber, and we all hated it. Eleanor gave out bottles to every woman she knew. Amelia Earhart sniffed it, twisted the top tightly, and handed it to her husband, George, who put it in his pocket. Eleanor gave a bottle to Tommy, over breakfast. Tommy held it up to the light, admired the green-ribbed glass, and pushed it back as if it was just too grand for the likes of her. Every time Eleanor put a bottle on my dresser, I put it back in her underwear drawer. She had 25 bottles of the stuff.
"Enough for everyone," she said.
And she put two of the bottles down on Missy's breakfast tray.
"Dear Missy, I'm so sorry to run off. Hick, darling, I'm so glad you can visit for a little while with Missy."
Missy looked at me. "I brought you some things," I said. "We're not going to sit here like dopes. I got cards, I got the newspaper, and I got you this." I took out the alphabet board I'd found at a school for the deaf. "Look at this thing." I tapped a few keys encouragingly, as if we weren't both damn good typists. She took the board in her left hand, which was weak but not useless like the right. "Go." "I can't go," I said. "You heard her. I'm visiting with you for a little while." She closed her eyes. I didn't blame her. I offered Missy bourbon from the bottle in my bag. "I won't tell if you won't," I said. "Just two scholarship girls, grabbing a drink while the fancy folks go about their business." She looked right at me, her wide white face trembling. "I know," I said. "I do know how it is. And you had it much better than I ever did. You weren't cropped out of all the photos. No one in the White House pretended not to know your name. Jesus Christ, Missy. I've come in more back doors and down more hidden staircases with more fake names than a Russian spy, but you, the attractive secretary and the dashing great man, especially dashing while in a wheelchair. Everyone loved that story." Missy and Franklin put a smile on reporters' faces. Eleanor and I were no one's favorite secret. I tended to scowl. Eleanor sometimes turned her face away. We were puzzling. I was not the travel companion the press wanted for her. Time magazine said I was rotund, with baggy clothes and a peremptory manner, and no one in the White House said, "Oh, my dear, how could they?" And it was clear, to all those men, covering her all the time, that there was something wrong with the picture, and the descriptions of me were even worse than the pictures. I'd spent my whole adult life with good-looking women sitting on my knee and expressing interest, but in the world of Time magazine and the New York Times, I was a musical comedy nanny. I was a fat sheepdog in rumpled clothes. Did they know Eleanor had my suits made? That I was wearing French silk panties, bought and paid for by the First Lady? My job, as the world saw it, was getting Eleanor Roosevelt from event to event, nipping at Mrs. Roosevelt's heels. But that was old news, and I was still around. I was still having lunch with Eleanor, still finding boxes of hand-me-down evening gowns in my armoire, still getting occasional checks with emphatically kind notes, and carrying on with Marion, which made me feel alive. Missy had nothing but bouquets bought by Eleanor. "Just you and me, kid," I said. "Come on, I'll tell you a story." Everything I'd seen, she'd seen, except the stories that were too private. I didn't expect her to tell me how it felt, helping Franklin from the chair to the bed and leaving that bed to run up to the third floor at 3 a.m. She didn't expect me to tell her about the time Eleanor and I found ourselves in ridiculous middle-aged passion in a not very large dressing room of Bergdorf Goodman, while Eleanor was still First Lady and looking for a new blouse. We were down to our slips and hose, her sitting on my lap, both of us bracing against the collapse of the little chair. It still made me smile. "I'll tell you what really happened when we went to Yosemite," Everyone loved that disaster. Her eyes came back to me, and her lips lifted a little on the left side. Everyone in America knew about our Yosemite vacation, which we privately called our second honeymoon, because I fell off a horse. Every newspaper covered the story, but no one had a photograph, and that was luck enough for me. The papers gave a whole column of comedy to Mrs. Roosevelt's bulky sidekick, sliding off a stubborn horse and one of our great national treasures, and into a creek surrounded by handsome park rangers. I was humiliated, but I wasn't hurt, and I managed to laugh, for Eleanor's sake. "Oh, Missy," I said, "I was just a fool, in public and private, on that holiday. I fell off a horse. I told the tourists to go to hell. I don't have your grace," I said. "Who doesn't like to hear that?" Missy nodded. Once we were back in the lodge, Eleanor hung up my clothes to dry and stuffed my boots with paper and put them by the fire. She poured sherry into two small tin cups and pulled me down to the quilt. "It's still just us," she said. "We're just Jane and Janet Doe making our way through the Wild West, and naturally, mistakes will occur." The fire flickered across her face, and she rubbed my sore feet, my aching legs. She swaddled me and kissed my forehead like I was an invalid. And when the sun came up, and there were more horses to ride and more tourists to charm, I smiled like a Roosevelt. I was a good sport, and she was very kind, and I appreciated her kindness, and she appreciated my good cheer. And somehow, that was that. In 4 years, we'd run out of possibilities. She wouldn't leave Franklin until he was out of office. Now, I didn't actually want her to. When she said she could, I pointed out how important he was to her own goals and to the country. When I said that maybe we could take a month in New Mexico, maybe we could get our own place in Manhattan, she pointed out that we'd have reporters everywhere, and always would. I couldn't pose successfully as her aide-de-camp because in public, she would take my hand sometimes, or press up against me, and in spite of myself, I had to tell her not to.
"I am this way with all my friends," she said.
It was true. They were all an endless daisy chain of pats and squeezes, of affection and endearments. "It looks different when it's us," I said. "I like it. Jesus, Eleanor, I love it. And that's the problem. We do not look like the dearest of friends. Trust me."
"I wonder if we aren't, really, the dearest of friends, deep down."
I drove back east by myself. I banged the living daylights out of an old girlfriend in San Fran, pardon my French, and I did my best to move forward without complaint. I didn't succeed, but I did try. It became a very popular story back east. For the next year, Franklin and his sons, and every other man in the White House, would give me a poke or a look whenever the subject of the national parks or horseback riding or even just vacations came up. "Can't live," Missy wrote. "Please." "You can," I said. "Looky here." I took mint and sugar out of my bag. I made us mint juleps in the honor of there being some horse race somewhere. I crushed the mint with my fingers and poured her drink into a cup and put in a straw. It was hard for her to get her lips around the straw, and she began to cry, only her right eye leaking tears. "Don't worry," I said. I poured the julep into a bowl, and I fed it to her. Missy swallowed a few times and put her left hand up to her mouth to stop me. "F.D.," she typed. I started to say that I was sure he'd come by soon, and I closed my mouth. I was no better than the rest of them. I packed up my julep fixings, I washed out the bowl, I left the little keyboard on the nightstand. I said that she must know how much all of the Roosevelts loved her, and that all we wanted, him especially, was for her to get well. Franklin had changed his will and let everyone in the family know that if he died before Missy, half of his estate would be put aside for her medical bills and ongoing care. Everyone acted as if this made sense, as if any man would do this for his devoted secretary and announce it to all. And Eleanor kept on with the fruit and the flowers and the visits, and so did I. I thought that if I was in Missy's shoes, I would hope somebody'd kill me. And if they couldn't do that, I hope they'd visit me and bring the bourbon. There wasn't enough bourbon. In February, Missy choked herself with a chicken bone from lunch. And if the nurse hadn't come back in to get the sweater she'd left behind, Missy would have died, vomiting blood on her sheets. In March, she set herself on fire in the middle of the night, matchbooks flaming at the four corners of the bed. Her hands and chest were burned. She needed gauze bandages on both hands for a little while. And a nurse had to feed her and turn pages for her. Come spring, Princess Martha of Norway fled the Nazis and became the White House's effervescent guest. In early May, Franklin came into Missy's room for 10 minutes. He went back downstairs to dinner with the princess. Missy had a relapse of some kind, and by 10 p.m., a nurse and a maid had packed up what Missy had and put her in a car for her sister's house in Somerville, Massachusetts. She could recover there, is what everyone said, by which we all meant suffer in private and not burn down the White House. According to the letters from her sister, things got better in Somerville. After 8 months, Missy could write her own brief notes, and she did. She didn't write to me, but she wrote to Grace Tully, and to Franklin, and to Eleanor, both of whom read her short, shaky letters aloud to each other, and sighed. She was walking now. She wrote. She was doing so well. Her bed had been moved back upstairs. Work took me near Somerville, and I wrote that I could come by in a week, with a note from Franklin and gifts from everyone. It was Tommy who put together the package, and Tully who ran down to give me a note from Franklin. Anna Lahand Rochon called me at the hotel and said that they would be happy to have me over for tea at 101 Orchard Street. There was nothing wrong with the house, pictures of Ireland, of the saints with the snakes, of the Irish grandparents, of her late parents, holding their two daughters on their lap, while the oldest, Missy's brother Daniel, stood aside, his hand on his mother's shoulder. Missy's nieces, whose names I'd learned and forgotten a dozen times, came downstairs out of curiosity. I stood in the doorway with my coat and hat still on, next to Missy's sister and the nieces, and we all watched Missy, in a loose sweater and dowdy plaid skirt, walk down the stairs very slowly. She gripped both stair rails, and she came down the way I sometimes do myself, letting one leg do most of the work, always taking the step down at an angle. I clasped both of Missy's thin hands so as not to knock her over, and we walked side by side to the sofa. Finally, one of the nieces took my coat and hat. I looked behind Missy and saw the big sterling cup Franklin had sent her, with a curly monogram of M-L-E-H on it. It had fresh roses in it.
"The Roosevelts have been so wonderful," Anna said. "They send gifts all the time."
Missy nodded and looked toward the coffee table, where there was a copy of The True Story of Falla, an insipid book about Franklin's dog, written by Cousin Daisy. It was open to an inscription from Franklin, and I picked it up and looked as I was supposed to.
"You know who's always here?" Missy's sister patted my arm. "Bill Bullitt. He sends notes. He comes by. He sends the craziest gifts, doesn't he, Missy? So extravagant. He's still in love with you, honey."
Missy nodded again. Most of us thought Bullitt chased Missy to catch Franklin, and no one thought much of him. Before her stroke, she'd carry on stagey, flirtatious phone conversations with him, and then hang up, rolling her eyes at whoever was nearby. And last year, when Franklin was completely fed up with the man, he told Bullitt that there'd be no promotions, no cabinet position coming, ever, and he encouraged him to run for mayor of Philadelphia. Bullitt said, all right, he would. And then Franklin called up every captain and cog in the Philadelphia machine the summer of 43 and told them, cut his throat. Eleanor told me she sat on the couch while he made the calls. He was in great spirits, she said. Bill Bullitt was an opportunistic, anti-Semitic, commie-chasing piece of shit. I didn't say that either. I said, "You look wonderful. Tell me what you've been up to." Her sister stiffened. Missy clasped her hands in front of her and rolled back her shoulders. She said, "I think, not much." Her sister laughed like Missy was such a comedian. "Oh, Missy, that's not true. You exercise, you read, you're wonderful with Babe and Barbara. Those are my daughters. We go to the movies. The president gets us tickets, you know." "That reminds me," I said. I handed Missy the note from Franklin. She dropped it and picked it up before I could help. She pressed it to her chest and made an ugly little sound in her throat. Her sister made a move to take it from her, and Missy moved it up to her bare skin. Missy said, "F.D. Anna poured more tea. Missy said, "Loves me." She nodded. I nodded back. Anna said that maybe Missy'd like to read it later. Missy nodded, her head tilting left, and then she held the note to her cheek. Anna said, "It's so wonderful that he took the time to write, honey." Missy lowered her eyes. "Speaking of the White House," I said, "your old beau, Bill Bullitt? Gosh, did you ever hear about the beautiful ball he gave in Moscow in the 30s? Talk about extravagant." I gave that story everything I had. I gave them detail upon detail, and what I didn't know, I made up. I told them about dancers from the Bolshoi twirling on point through birch trees placed in the chandelier room, recreating the Russian countryside. I described the long dining room table, covered with finished tulips from end to end, and chicory planted in rolls of wet felt to make a living lawn inside the ballroom. There were parakeets and a few pheasants and zebra finches. "Zebra finches are so beautiful," I said, and I described them like an avid bird watcher. "Plus," I said, "the man brought in goats." "Goats," Anna said gamely. "How crazy is that? And white roosters, and a baby bear." "The poor little bear got drunk on champagne. It was all written about in a famous Russian novel," I said. "It was called The Spring Ball of the Full Moon."
"Isn't that wonderful?" Anna said. "I can just picture it."
Missy said something that sounded like wonderful. I think I stayed long enough to show whatever it was I thought I needed to show. I kissed Missy goodbye and shook hands with her sister and waited in the front hall while they rounded up the daughters who waved from the stairs. I got back in my car and thought, Jesus Christ, please let me never complain again about anyone or anything. Part 3. Remembrance has a front and a rear. We came back from our northern holiday, more in love than when we'd left. People could see it a mile away. People asked Eleanor if she'd changed her hair. They told me I'd lost weight. We acted like people who'd leaped off the shipwreck just in time and found themselves on a desert island with sunshine, shelter, and plenty of pineapples. I smiled when I saw other reporters. I could live without the bylines. Easy. The night we came back, we were invited to a big lesbian dinner party with some of Eleanor's old friends from Mademoiselle Silvestre's boarding school. "Your debut," Eleanor said. There were married ladies with a wandering eye, and Eleanor's seven sister friends in Harris tweeds and jaunty walking sticks. Silver swan handle. Are you kidding me? And elegant English walking shoes. Lobs. The woman next to me said, holding up her foot like I should sail right over and order a pair. One woman was divorced, and after two martinis, she said she was as happy on the day that they got divorced as she was when they got married, and maybe more. Eleanor looked down at her plate. Everyone talked about whichever girl they'd had a crush on in boarding school. Eleanor had been the reigning princess at Allenswood, which apparently made me every junior girl who laid flowers at her feet. Screamed for her on the hockey field, where I would have kicked her ass, I'm pretty sure, and made her bed for her while she was brushing her teeth. The women laughed and clinked glasses. Here's to mad passion and pash madness. Eleanor squeezed my hand in front of everyone, which was not a small thing, and then she said,
oh, dearest, you know what English boarding schools are like.
I sat up straight, representing my people, the hired girls of South Dakota, and I said, oddly enough, I have no idea at all about boarding schools, English, French, or fuck all. The prettiest woman from the old boarding school days coughed up her champagne, and everyone pounded her on the back. Someone asked me what I did, and Eleanor broke in to tell them I was Harry Hopkins' right-hand man, and there was suitable tittering. I was invited to describe the terrible things I'd seen in our great country by two women who did care, and by women who were on their third glass of champagne. And then there were strawberries and cream. And then we went back to the White House, and we made love, but we didn't talk. For 2 years, I took my job for the Federal Emergency Relief Administration seriously. I traveled across the country and wrote to Eleanor and to Harry Hopkins every week about the Depression, women dying in city hospitals, lying in the corridors, four in a row, piss and shit dropping on the floor, like there were so many cows. If they were poor enough, and one of the adults was able enough, they could do the work some pencil pusher thought they should do, for a wage that didn't upset the local businesses. Farmers watched their babies get through the flu, survive mumps and measles, and then die of just plain starvation, before they turned two. Small boys and girls, still a little unsteady on their feet, pulled sugar beets from dawn till dusk. Gray-faced women tried to tidy their shacks the way my mother had. Sweep the dirt out to the yard, watch it drip back in like a grim brown tide, wet two cloths, tie one over your hair and forehead, and use the other one to clean the sills and clean the table so you could make some kind of meal without the dust and cottonwood filling your mouth. A girl, skinny and still flat-chested, saw my fedora and my coat and smelled my cigarette. She said, mister, I cost you a dime. I said, it was all right. I'd give her the dime if she went home. She put out her filthy hand for the dime and walked up to the next corner, making sure I wasn't following and cutting into business. I stayed in a tent village in the Ozarks and saw a river of sewage cut a path down the middle of a dirt road. I stood in rubber boots at the edge of the water, and I had to go back to my car when the toughest little boy, my shirtless hero, started fishing things out with a stick and a hairpin. He made a pile and stood guard over it, so when he was done, he could wash it in the lake 2 miles away, and then, as he told me, he'd sell it maybe, or anyways, something for his sisters. I had my nose rubbed in my own racialism so often and so hard by meeting colored people who were so much worse off and had been hard done by for so much longer. Negro men and women, working from Ken to Kant, surrounded by a sea of hungry, wide-eyed children, and at least one rail-thin, night-dark old lady in the corner, sitting like a seer in her one dress, all knowing that their suffering registered less, that their dead weighed less, that there was less chance they could climb out of this terrible canyon, and fewer people to reach for them as they did. I finally had to give it up, and it hurt me, I tell you, to understand that the Hickoks of Bodel, South Dakota, with shoes from a dead girl to wear on school days only and oatmeal for dinner, were lucky people. I have no life but this. Saturday morning, April 28, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. We'd napped, rolling over to find each other. I reached for her before I opened my eyes. She's in the living room, reading already. She looks up and smiles. She doesn't put up her arms for me.
I've been reading for an hour, she says. There's more tea, and a letter from Missy Lehan's nieces, and one from her brother.
2 years ago, I was living down the hall from Eleanor. We'd had a modest wartime Christmas. No rubber, no metal, no sugar, no butter. Eleanor and I exchanged gifts. A check from her. A blue scarf I got from the Democratic National Committee and put in a new box for her. In her room. And we walked downstairs for cocktails. Chased as sisters. Franklin held up a cocktail shaker. And a letter from Anna LaHand. Anna LaHand had written Franklin that Missy was a wreck. She spelled out every detail of Missy's infinite misery, and finally Franklin said it was a damn shame, and he'd invited Missy to come for a week's visit, as soon as she was up for it. Eleanor nodded pleasantly, and pointed out that there was not a single empty bedroom. Franklin waved his hand to show how little this detail mattered. 3 days later, Missy's sister wrote back to say that this was the best possible news, that Missy was very excited, and when could she bring Missy down? Franklin handed the note to Eleanor, and Eleanor had Tommy write to say regrettably it wasn't possible at this time, but they would, of course, reschedule. Missy's sister made damn sure the visit was rescheduled because she loved her sister and hoped to God that they could get out of Somerville and claw their way back to important meetings and White House dinners with evening gowns and matching jackets. But it was canceled again while I was out of town. Only Eleanor could have done that. I doubt Franklin thought any more about Missy, and if she had come, she'd have been Eleanor's problem then, too. I only knew because Grace Tully had no one else to tell. On July 31st, 1944, Missy's sister wrote, furiously, that they'd gone to the movies. There was a newsreel of the president, and Missy rose unsteadily in the middle of it, and announced to the theater that she needed to go home, immediately. That night, she took out all of her albums and letters from Franklin and laid them on her bed. She opened every page to a picture of him. She had a stroke and called out his name and fell onto the pile. She was 48. Not old. Franklin was on his way to Alaska. Bill Bullitt was in Naples. None of the Roosevelt children came, except James's ex-wife, Betsy the starlet, who chatted up Eleanor at the interminable wake. Eleanor and I, and the old postmaster general, Jim Farley, and Bishop Cushing, and Judge Frankfurter, both of whom knew what was what, and young Tip O'Neill, and vile Joe Kennedy, came to the funeral at Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. Eleanor and I sat while the statement from the White House press secretary was read. The White House emphasized faithful and painstaking. Franklin hadn't seen her for almost 3 years. He found a few different ways to say it was a great thing, the way she'd laid down her life for his, with selfless efficiency. He said she had a real genius for getting things done, by which he meant things for him. The cigarette. The blanket, the cushion, the prompt arrival of the presidential car, preceded by her deflecting everyone's attention from the quick carry of the president down a back stair. Missy was a genius at shining the light just so. She delivered the notes, indicating yes, when everyone in the White House knew the answer was and always would be no. The press secretary wrote, faithful and painstaking, with charm of manner inspired by tact and kindness of heart. She was utterly selfless in her devotion to duty. Hers was a quiet efficiency, which made her a real genius in getting things done. Her memory will ever be held in affectionate remembrance and appreciation, not only by all the members of our family, but by the wide circle of those whose duties brought them into contact with her. There's a large rock nearby with a bronze plaque that simply reads, LaHand, and Missy's buried next to her sister, nowhere near Hyde Park. The Roosevelts paid for the funeral, and her headstone carries a quote from that press release, like a letter of reference. She was utterly selfless in her devotion to duty. Franklin D. Roosevelt. I don't think she would have liked more visits from me. There was nothing I could bring or say that would have helped. Eleanor and Franklin paid for the casket and the blanket of red and white flowers that covered it. "He ate her," I said to Eleanor on the drive home. "For 20 years. Those were the bones."
"Oh, really, Hick?" Eleanor said.
"Good night, sweetheart." Later, Saturday morning, April 28, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. Eleanor passes me more letters and begins reading aloud. "This is from Parker Fisk," she says. She waves a large white envelope marked Eleanor Roosevelt. It says, "Deliver to Eleanor Roosevelt in the event of my demise." "Do you think Parker's dead?" Eleanor had taken lessons to get her high, fluting voice under control, which she almost has. And now, when she's distressed, she sounds like a bored radio announcer from Illinois. I say, "If he died in the last 3 weeks, we'd have heard about it. I'm sure he's fine." But even if he's not dead, I don't think he's fine. By the time we got to know each other, Parker was never fine. "You could call White Horse Hill if you're worried," I say. She cleans her glasses and reads to me. 18-4-45. White Horse Hill Manor. White Horse Hill, Maryland. "Dear Eleanor, I am so sorry. The loss of Franklin is as terrible to me as the loss of my own mother was. I can only imagine how dark these days have been for you. But I know you. I know every time one of us stumbles to express how sorry we are for your loss, you'll say the right thing. In fact, I'm sure you've had to say it 100 times, to all sorts of people, to every simpering Roosevelt cousin. I know you will find it unkind for me to say, but that flock that followed him, that gaggle of admirers, seem to have been chosen entirely for their ability to fawn without pausing for lunch. And to the haberdasher from Missouri. You put your hand on every shoulder, and you tell them that you are, in your turn, very sorry for them. You are kindness itself, but in that sweet, fluting tone, there's more than a hint of, 'If I can pull myself together, dear, surely you can too.' You are kindness itself. You have never once spoken of my meetings with Miss Hickok, but I feel sure that she told you about them. I would say that it was not my finest moment, but that list of not fine moments is quite long. I have to add to them tonight. By the time you get this, I hope I'm dead." Eleanor looks up over her glasses. "I doubt it," I say.
"You had a conversation. You had conversations with my cousin Parker Fisk. About what?" she says, in exactly the tone Parker Fisk was writing about. "He was a tall, lean, mean, well-dressed man. He had a long, disdainful face and steel-framed spectacles. He never looked out of place at the White House. He looked like what he was, a Roosevelt cousin, a page at their wedding, a famously deft, much-married diplomat who knew how to wrestle other countries into agreements. He looked like a man who knew how to ride horses, and which fork to use, and how to properly address the younger brother of Duke. And he was. He didn't look like a man who propositioned working-class men, white and black, in every possible conveyance. I'm just remarking that this stuff took place in trains and cabs, in horse-drawn carriages, in the back of limousines, and on cruise ships, barges, and large sailboats. I think that's what almost saved him, and that's what brought him low. People didn't see his homosexual self coming, unlike yours truly, and that bothered them. He didn't look at all like that type of man, so everyone who liked him, smart and charming and so good at his job, pretended it didn't happen, or that somehow it had happened, but only due to a mix of bourbon and misunderstanding. I don't know what kind of misunderstanding it could have been. No pussy down there? My mistake, sir. The only time I ever heard Franklin refer to it, nothing was explained.
Franklin was presiding at dinner one night in 33 when Amelia Earhart was our new best friend, and Eleanor and I were in the throes. We dressed each other to the nines. Her in Eleanor blue with navy piping and me in navy silk with Eleanor blue at the waist. We each wore a white orchid on our right lapel. Honestly, you couldn't miss us. Dinner with other people then always left us restless and giddy, like thoroughbreds before a race. But dinners with Franklin wore me out. He was the handsomest man in every room, and he was president. He always had Missy by his side, and sometimes another pretty woman, or even a pair seated near him, for no reason except to please his eye. I appreciated the pretty girls, the way I appreciated a nice vase or a very good but not great painting. Eleanor did too. We didn't aspire to it. We admired it. When we were young women, there was fear and envy for her, desire and worry for me. But we got older. If you wait, everyone gets tired, and the glittery gifts people carry will mostly be tossed aside just so they can cross the finish line. We both like pretty women well enough, for different reasons. But by 50, neither of us envied them. You cannot fault a man for what he does when he's intoxicated. Franklin meant Parker Fisk. Fisk wouldn't have to resign for another 10 years, but people were talking about him. Eleanor said, "Really?" I said, "Do the ladies also get a pardon?" I hope Franklin thought so, but it didn't matter. Eleanor didn't think so. Eleanor thought that if you were a person of advantages and intelligence, you were responsible for every single thing you did or said and every choice you made until the day they laid you in the ground. That's how she lived her whole sainted life. If Eleanor had been Franklin, I would have worried about infidelity. I would have known that I was married to a charming liar. I wouldn't have been able to stand how easily she'd tell me one thing on Monday and another on Tuesday without a blush. Eleanor has only one face, and it's the face I love most in the world. But for the day-to-day business of being human, Franklin was easier. Amelia was in great form that night, sitting across from her idiot husband, George. Amelia said, "You can't possibly mean that, Mr. President. And vino veritas, after all. We show our true colors, however unattractive, when we're drunk." "Exactly," Franklin said, and raised his coffee cup to show that dinner was over, and wheeled off, laughing like hell. Amelia turned to Eleanor and me and said, "That's why I don't drink, do I, G.P.?" G.P., George Putnam, went to Harvard and married society ladies before and after Amelia. He owned 3 cars and 5 horses and 4 tuxes. I know because he told me. And still, sitting across from Amelia, who glittered like a wicked fairy, George looked like the poor fisherman in the folktale who'd gotten his wish and lived to regret it. He nodded glumly. "Nothing wrong with a drink once in a while," he mumbled. Amelia said, "I think women, some women, regard matrimony as a highly honorable retreat from the possibility of failure in the larger world." I said, "Maybe some women." And Eleanor drank her water, and Amelia kept talking. "After all, it's nothing more than an attractive cage, and some of us, we have to spread our wings, don't we, my dears?" She winked at Eleanor. She lifted her pretty arms under her sheer, spangled chiffon wrap so it slid to the floor, and George picked it up for her. She managed to make me sorry for him. "Please, finish Parker's letter," I say. "Then we can talk." Eleanor looks at me over her glasses and reads to me quietly, without inflection. I was lying in a ditch, in my robe and pajamas, earlier this evening. I plan to go back there when I finish this letter. The ditch runs across the ass end of the property, behind the last row of cypress trees and yews. I tripped over the roots of an old maple tree and slid, ass over tea kettle, into the ditch and lay there, wedged in the dirt, like a soldier at Ypres. I confess to you. I threatened the butler tonight. He threatened me. He stood on the other side of the kitchen table, white apron wrapped as tight as a cummerbund around his waist, shirt starched like a sheet of ice, and his cuffs rolled up to show his revolting monkey wrists. We had a drink together. I was tired and put my hand on Bauer's shoulder as I sat down. He didn't move away. I remember this the way I remember much of the past, through a smoky bourbon haze. That's how I remember my first honeymoon, when I found myself in black and white striped silk dressing gown and some sort of French lounge pants, plus silver-plated cigarette holder, and not a shred of humor about my whole getup, in a suite of the Grand Hotel de Vesuvio in Milan. The bellman took his time unpacking our bags, and when my first wife, Deborah, went into the large and beautiful bathroom, he hung up my jackets and my trousers, smoothing the legs. He looked at me, running his slim, tan fingers round and round the waistband of my suit pants until Deborah came out again, her hair fixed, her dimples showing. That evening, I wandered, which is how I like to think of myself then, a diffident traveler making his way through unfamiliar terrain. Oh la, who knows what I'll find behind this tree, into the dusty basement. There was luggage, a coat rack, a bench and a sprung armchair, a dozen brooms, a row of grimy but uniform dustpans, and the beautiful boy. I extended our visit, and for years Deborah would tell people, "Say what you want about Florence and Rome. Parker and I adored Milan." In the kitchen tonight, I told Bauer I'd give him the bottle, if he could beat me in arm wrestling. He nodded. I have longer arms, the better fulcrum, and I beat him twice, nearly coming out of my seat to do it. I felt his warm, wet hand in mine, his arm under me. I said, "Ich habe gewonnen," and he bowed his head a little. We clinked glasses, and just as I thought things were going as smoothly as they could, that I would not find myself miserable and alone in my big bed, he stood up. He put his hand on my head and guided it toward his crotch. I pushed his hand away and stood up. I said that it was time for us to call it a night. I said there had been a misunderstanding. He didn't stand aside, and I gave him a shove just to clear my way. I was very tired. Sibylle came into the kitchen with a small bag and her big fur. She nodded to Bauer and smiled at me, as if we were in a lovely room, not a depressing kitchen. She looked me in the eye, so as not to look at anything else, and said that she was going to visit friends. I said that the roads were getting bad, and that was enough. She pushed up her sleeves, ready to box, and said that there could be snow, hell or high water on the roads tonight, but she wasn't staying in this house with me, in the mood I was in. I said I wouldn't have another drink until Memorial Day. She said, "You couldn't pay me to go through another day with you." We had reached that point. I followed her into the front hall and watched her put on her coat. I tried a few husbandly gestures, my hand to her elbow, steadying her with the boots, pushing forward to lift her bag into the car. She ignored me. She walked to the car and left the front door open. The blue Chrysler pulled away, snow spraying, taking a big slide to the right. I watched until the twin tire prints were covered. I fell asleep in the library and woke up to Bauer putting on his overcoat, knocking things over in the front hall. He carried his suitcase. "You don't have to leave," I said. "It's coming down hard." "No longer," he said. He opened the door. Sibylle's tracks were gone entirely. The dark night air dotted with flakes and fresh as a forest. Bauer walked out and got into a beat-up Dodge sedan. The driver tapped his horn. I should have said something conciliatory. I should have taken Franklin's approach and made a joke out of it, as if nothing had passed at all, and only a fool would think it had. I'm famous for reconciling opposite parties all over the world. I have no conciliation left in me. I want to be loved, the way my dear mother and my first wife loved me. And if I can't have that, I want to be desired fiercely. I want a man who will find me and never lose me. I have found that man, as it turns out. And the day before Christmas, I told him we could never see each other again. It's not our habit to be candid with each other, but I would like, even if it's just while I'm writing, to imagine that I'll send this, and that you'll know who I really am, and you'll love me still. I would like, for this little while, not to be in disguise. And I like to imagine that at least while you're reading this, you are not in disguise either. These days, you are usually disguised as First Lady. Sometimes when I see you in those drafty halls, I hardly know you. Franklin himself was disguised only by his health. His performance as a man who had difficulty walking was one of the greatest performances of the 20th century. To see him standing with his cane, leaning into the wind, hatless and defiantly cheerful, was to deny even the passing thought that if he had no strong man by his side, he would have fallen to the ground. Instantly. One more cheerful note. I've been looking up pictures from your wedding this evening. I remember every detail of your royal wedding. I know, we both know, how the world came to see Franklin, but back then, Franklin was a bit of a stiff and not much of an athlete. He didn't get into a good club at Harvard. He joked around like a missionary and drank like a guilty altar boy. And didn't he overcome both? Con Brio. The man married you and devoured charm. They put me in a page's suit for your wedding. Those were the days of mountains of ferns, allays of white ribbon, fields of white Prince of Wales ostrich feathers tipped with silver, the other Roosevelt's obsession with the ridiculous coat of arms, and pink roses everywhere. Among Roosevelts, you could not escape roses. Cousin Alice, no prettier than you, less clever, and so much worse a human being, did the same at her wedding. There were pale pink roses by the bushel, down the staircase, in the bridesmaid bouquets, and those silver urns the size of a large child, and across the mantles of Sissy Parrish's two drawing rooms. Your bridesmaids came down the stairs, perfecting their sulky, virginal sway, down 34 steps. I was 12. I was bubbling over, sweating and smelling, breaking out in small red patches on my chest and my cheeks. You turned around and gave me one of your sweet smiles. Just as I was about to pick up your train, my mother darted forward with rice paper. She patted my face to mop up what she could, and she smoothed my hair, which was standing up like pokeweed. My mother was really very fond of you. She said that Grandma Mary Hall dragged you home from France, and your feminist hotbed for no reason but polite society. Eleanor does not complain, she said. I complained all the time. I even complained about having to be a page and wear a cravat, but I was proud of it and of my job, carrying the train. I complained about having to walk behind your grandmother, Mary. Your grandmother managed, like a lot of rich old people, and I find that I'm just like this, to insult people and take offense in the same sentence. She told me I was not to get in your way, and when I rubbed my nose, just for something to do, she patted her chest and said that she hoped I wasn't suggesting that there was anything wrong with the air in the apartment, that she had not thought she'd be insulted by a weedy little boy on the morning of her granddaughter's wedding. Both women were in black. Both smelled like camphor and attar of roses. I can smell it now. The acrid, biting scent overpowering a dull, wistful one. I was 12. I believe that homosexuals are born, not made. But if I'm wrong, it was those old ladies that turned me. Your Uncle Teddy led us all into the reception and told story after story. The men who liked him roared. The women sparkled. Aunt Edith smiled behind her fan. Paul and I found the spiked punch and took it into the back garden, drinking cupfuls as fast as we could until my father found us. Father smacked me on the back of the head. He pulled Hall up and said, "Your sister relies on you," and Hall vomited into the chinaberry. When we were both about to graduate from Harvard, Hall took me to a show. That night was his gift to me. An enormous man swung overhead, his feet almost grazing my head. He was twice the size of Uncle Teddy, and if you'll forgive me, in a black bathing costume and bare feet, and his thighs and backside splayed out and hung over the seat. He grabbed onto the leather straps of the swing with big hands, and I could see that underneath the black suit was another red-striped suit. Sweat ran down his sides. The man pumped his legs and tossed red silk flowers into the audience. He must have weighed 300 pounds. He wore a straw hat, a boater, like all our uncles and cousins wore at picnics, and his calves were like bowling balls, white-blue and very smooth. A few weeks before the nightclub debacle, I'd made a picnic for Hall and me. We went down to the Charles and found one of those great willow trees, its soft branches pooling on the grass. I suggested we sit inside the canopy, and he laughed. "That's baloney. Let's get some sun." He took off his shirt and socks and shoes and rolled up his trouser legs. I took up my sweater and folded it beside me. Two boys we knew rode by, and they whooped. Hall jumped up, waving, and waggled his hips at them. His feet were beautiful. The toenails were smooth and rosy, and each round, sturdy, clean toe had a couple of tiny gold hairs on it. We sat on the lawn, overlooking the river, drinking ale, eating apples and sausage rolls I'd stolen from the kitchen. That was my great daring. That's all I was capable of. His pants hiked up his shins, and I could see more gold hairs, a little darker, above his sharp white perfect ankle bone. You know what a handsome young man he was in his 20s. My feet, like every other part of me, were disgusting to me. I'd mastered the manly art of never being naked, and of appearing not to notice anyone else's nakedness. I don't know if that's how it is in girls' schools. I knew I looked nothing like Michelangelo's David, or any of the sculptures in our art books, or the statues in Auntie Bi's garden, where she refused to put up fig leaves, and said that if anyone was so uncultured to be offended, they should just close their ignorant eyes. We could use more of that. That nightclub was heaven and hell for me. Lipstick men danced together. An actual girl, looking like Mary Pickford, except for her backless pinafore, offered Hall a pink rose for 50 cents. He put it in his lapel and sent her away. The big man from the swing had put on a silk dressing gown, leather boots on his bare legs, and a monocle. He did look like Uncle Teddy, and he was not unaware of the resemblance.
"Oh, it's a bully night, isn't it, my dears? Bully, bully, bully. I see you little rough riders out there. Daddy sees all. And now, lock your lips and hide your slips, because here to show you how to speak softly and carry a great big stick, and also vice versa, here is Miss Gladys Bentley."
People yelled and clapped. A Negro woman came in, large and handsome, in a white tux and top hat. She chucked men and women under the chin. She nuzzled a white girl, who screamed with pleasure. Two boys fanned themselves. She hammered at the piano, like it was her last night on earth. And while she sang in her deep, whiskey voice, two very pretty girls, one light, one dark, climbed onto the baby grand and sang back up. "Blow it upright with my own dynamite. I'm knocking down this city, knocking it all down tonight." Hall cheered. I clapped politely, coward that I was, and am. Hall pushed me toward every invert he saw. I stood my ground and finally sat down at the table nearest the coat check. "Look," he said, "let's have a ball. This place is great." I asked him, browsing all the way, if he'd been here before. "You goop. Who am I going to go with? Margaret? No, this is for us. This is our bachelor party. Without the rest of the fellows. Our send-off." He didn't say, "the rest of the fellows who didn't care for you. The rest of the fellows who understand perfectly well what lies beneath." One boy, without lipstick and dressed much like us, approached me. Hall was very warm, but I think the boy must have seen that my strongest wish was to murder him, and he shrugged. he said to me. Suit yourself, Petal. I grabbed my jacket,